Good afternoon. Welcome to ArtsWave Arts Wrap. I'm Alicia Kintner, President and CEO of ArtsWave. And this is our fairly regular podcast series, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts, like Spotify, Arts Wrap with Alicia. So I'm joined by two really fabulous colleagues that I have the pleasure of working with in a variety of ways. First, to my right is Tyson Betts. He is Design Vice President and Right Brain to the Business for Global Family Care at Procter & Gamble. And Harold Brown. Harold is the Honorable Nathaniel R. Jones, Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer for the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Welcome, Harold and Tyson.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about how we shake up audiences for the arts in Cincinnati. We have such an incredible foundation of arts institutions that goes back to the 1800s. The Cincinnati Symphony was started in 1885?
I believe that's thereabouts. Exactly right, actually.
Excellent. Yeah. We go way back with the symphony and then the May Festival Chorus and the opera. Fast forward 150 years, we have some of the most diverse and thriving and energetic new organizations on the scene at the same time. And Tyson, you've been involved with a number of those.
Very happy to be involved in the arts in Cincinnati.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did you both grow up here?
I grew up in Oxford, Ohio.
Okay.
Went away to college in Massachusetts and then moved back to the Cincinnati area in the early 90s.
Excellent. So you've seen change, but you've also kind of always known the arts to be part of our environment. What about you, Tyson?
I grew up in L.A. No, Lower Alabama.
I grew up in L.A. You knew that.
I grew up in Alabama, finished high school in Birmingham, and came to Cincinnati by way of Baltimore.
Okay.
So I've been punted around a little.
Circuitous route. Mm-hmm. I think people who haven't been born and raised in Cincinnati are kind of surprised by what we have here. I don't know if that's been your experience. We hear from other PNGers that the arts are sometimes a surprise by their quality and variety.
I think absolutely. I mean, my experience was, I came to Cincinnati quite a while ago. and at the time would say that it was not the easiest city to come to as an outsider, but I really found my way into Cincinnati, into the fabric of the community through the arts and through the arts organizations. That, I mean, it's just a fundamental part of who I am. And so it was a natural way for me to find my way into the city.
Oh, that's wonderful. I believe that that's absolutely right, that the arts are a great way to make connections. But I also know that sometimes our arts institutions aren't considered as welcoming or as understanding or as interesting to everyone as we want them to be. And Harold, I think that's what your role is all about at the CSO.
Without question. That is a central challenge, particularly in some of the legacy arts organizations like symphonies, that they are perceived as for the elite, wealthy, white citizens, and not as welcoming for others. And so we, among other things, are trying to change that perception through a variety of means that we'll talk about. But there's no question that that's the way it's perceived by large amounts of the population.
That's so unfortunate because all of us who work in the arts, are so passionate and committed and want to embrace everybody. Yeah. But it is something that we know we need to work on. Now, a chief diversity and inclusion officer is a fairly common role at our large corporations, our business partners. But is it common in the symphony world?
No. At the time that I was hired, I knew of only one other in Philadelphia who had just begun that position about 4 months prior to mine. And also tellingly, the largest performing arts organization in the country, the New York Metropolitan Opera, had just hired a Cincinnatian, Marcia Sells, to be their first ever Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer 1 month before I started.
Wow.
Recently, I met with some of my peers at a conference in Detroit. Now there are probably 14 or 15 of us at major orchestras across the country. So it has really taken off in the past couple of years, but we're all trying to find our way in many ways and building upon, I think in most cases, some things that were already in place, but trying to move things forward.
That is so interesting. Cincinnati has historically led the way for the country in the arts in a lot of respects. Mm-hmm. And now in fostering greater inclusion in legacy arts institutions is another way.
Yes.
So thank you, Harold, for taking on that role. Your background is not specifically arts. You've been in education, healthcare, philanthropy. So what has surprised you most coming into an arts institution with a long history?
I think on the not so positive side is the sort of entrenched way of doing things. More often than not, when you ask why something is the way it is, the answer is because it's always been that way. And so that's a bit of a challenge. And not through, you know, a malicious intent, but people have gotten comfortable with certain ways that business is handled, the way that the things happen. On the other hand, though, I am finding some extraordinary openness, particularly amongst our team. Our president is unapologetic about our D&I work, and our senior management team, with whom I work very closely across the whole organization, I'm finding to be far more welcoming and collaborative than I could have ever hoped for. This work has to be embedded. I didn't come in, you know, throwing chairs, calling everybody, you know, racist, and what I wanted to do was build this from the ground up, so that if I were to leave or our CEO were to leave, that this work doesn't revert back. So it's really been an amazing first couple of years to work across the organization and embed DE&I strategies in every aspect of the work. And the most important thing that's happened, frankly, is that all the conversations are different. I don't have to be in the room, and somebody is still bringing up inclusivity, community, diversity. So it's really gratifying to see that it's taking root and people are owning this work beyond just me.
That's wonderful and encouraging. Mm-hmm. There's a lot at stake, and yeah, embedded across all areas of the business is important. When you look out at the Symphony audience, who's in the room?
Well, my wife and I joke that because we go frequently, and we say, you look across the audience, you see white hair or no hair. So we have not only one of the oldest audiences in the country, but we have a declining group of aging folks. I think you've heard me quote the data that shows that in 10 years, almost half of the current attendees will either be dead or unable to attend in person. Wow. Now, the interesting thing is that statistic has been quoted for decades, but because of the aging population of baby boomers, there was always a group behind the aging population to fill that gap, not so much in the past two decades, because the population is different than it was 40 and 50 years ago. So that is a huge challenge for us. And so our vision is to be the most relevant orchestra in America, which means we have to become attractive, affordable, and accessible to a much broader swath of the community than the wonderful supporters and traditional subscribers. So it's not doing away with what's made us good and great and well known, but it's expanding that to include folks who traditionally have not found the Symphony to be a destination point.
That's sobering. And, you know, a threat to the business model, if you will. Tyson, you're in a lot of meetings that I'm in. You're on the ArtsWave Board of Directors. You've also been board chair of the Art Academy, board chair of Elements Hip Hop Youth Organization. You advise ArtsWave on Flow, our African-American arts series. And you're obviously in your day job caring a lot about how customers feel about products and how do we grow customers, grow brands, grow enrollment, grow audiences. How are you looking at this?
I think there's a lot of similarities when I look at what's happening and evolving in the business world and what's happening and evolving in the arts world. They're very similar, right? The audiences that we serve is evolving very quickly.
Yeah.
Things are changing very quickly. The world that established the norms that we are used to using to operate are no longer the truths that we can use to operate. So just as, you know, as from a business standpoint, just as we need to adapt our strategies and our content and our product to meet the evolving needs of the consumer, I think on the arts front, we need to do the same as well. So not only from the habits and practices that the audience has, but even just the diversity of the audiences that we serve, we have to change our approach if we want to reach and be resonant with those audiences.
Do you look around the arts community? Because I know you attend a lot of things. You've got kids that are attending things. Where... Where do you see the most diversity in audiences?
Wow. I'll try to answer it a little differently.
Okay.
I think the places I've seen and been most surprised is where I'd say folks are doing a bit of a remix, right? So they're inviting in what I think are some uncommon connections as a way to be able to reach a more diverse audience. So if you think about some of the work that the symphony has done, some of the work that the ballet has done to really invite in elements in some of those occasions or others in some of those occasions. You think about what Cincinnati Art Museum has done to really diversify its exhibition program and making some very significant exhibitions happen on a relatively short timeline that speak to an audience that's different than their traditional audience. Those kinds of remixes, those kinds of rethinking, I think is what's required to really figure out how to sustain the arts ecosystem.
That's a great point. And I guess what you're saying is that part of the issue is the product itself.
Right. Right. I mean, we cannot continue to sell the same product, whether in business or the arts, if the audience itself is changing and evolving, the things they care about is changing and evolving, the way they think about themselves is changing and evolving. You can't use the same strategies to move the same product and expect the same level of engagement. It's just not going to happen.
And I'm sure that P&G has a whole lot of people who think about that every day. And that's why you're the world's leading consumer product company, right? In the arts, we don't have that many people able to do R&D and be innovative. We try. And Harold, I think the CSO has been experimenting with a variety of approaches to product and content. You want to
speak to that? We have a fairly new vice president of marketing who has intensified our efforts to understand our audience and our community and work with our programming people to, as Tyson has just said, to make sure that we're appealing to them and their needs while not, again, doing away with the staples, if you will, that have been part of our work over the years. But we're doing experimental things with format. A lot of the young folks don't want to come in and sit on their hands for 2.5 hours. They want a shorter format. So we have some 85-minute no intermission programs that are with some different kinds of music and spoken word and whatnot. We have we're doing a lot in the community. We're taking the orchestra out. We have acquired funding for 5 full-blown concerts in underrepresented neighborhoods and parks across the city. So this year we're really amplifying that, ramping that up. So looking at a variety of ways to appeal to a younger, more diverse demographic as a matter of survival, frankly, down the road. And I think it's beginning to pay off. I don't have ironclad strategies to increase the number of youth and diverse folks that come to our traditional concerts. But we know that depending on who's on stage, we can fill the house or close to fill the house.
Yeah.
So it's a question of how much of that can we do? And I think the real potential is in mixing in our programs.
Yes.
So that we had a program last year, one of my favorites, where we had, I think, Bernstein and Beethoven. But in between, we had a piece by William Dawson, who's a lesser-known African-American composer, deceased, long deceased, but who's had some great work that was never really performed. And so not only did that draw a more diverse audience, but it also exposed the majority audience to something that they had never heard before. So that artistic richness that comes through, I think, is appealing on a broader way, too. So we have a variety of strategies that are designed to appeal to a much broader swath of the community.
That's great. It leads me to lots of questions. So, Tyson, you zeroed in that it's a product content question. And Harold, you added in this idea of how we're marketing and communicating. So which do you guys think it is more of, the product content or the communication?
I'd say yes.
Both things can be true.
I think they're both true, right? So I think finding content that, I mean, if you market content that's not relevant or resonant, you're not going to get a response. And so I think it's a hand-in-hand proposition, right? One of the things that I have had to remind myself of, particularly over the last few weeks, is the need to be empathetic and really understand the audience whom you're serving. If you're trying to give them something they don't want, they're not going to be very receptive to it. So a first step might just be better understanding what is relevant, what is resonant, and how might you then be able to create the content that makes the need and the attraction mutual to each other. So I think the marketing and the content has to go hand in hand.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I think we are finally stepping up our data collection so that we can understand what people want and will come to pay for or to see, and try to be as responsive to that as we can. But also understand the experience that they're having when they do come. Because even if they enjoy the content, if they have a lousy experience, they don't feel like they belong or that they are respected or welcomed, they may not come back. So you know, a lot of times in DEI work, we focus on the D and not the I. So we are putting a lot of effort into thinking about how people, both staff, as well as audience members, musicians, everybody, how you experience the CSO so that our diversity efforts will pay off by people finding it to be a place that they want to be. But yes, there's no question about it that we have to market based on our understanding of what people really desire to see and what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so to get at that, you really do have to ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, it's one of our challenges. That, you know, so if you look at, for example, our African-American audience, it's been about 6% over the past several years. And if we do post-concert surveys, which is our primary way of understanding the experience that people are having, if you know, only 10 or 20% of that 6% reply, that's a very small end.
Yes.
So we have to do better at incentivizing in other ways, getting that feedback, focus groups, what have you. So that's an important part of our work so that we can then design programming that that will keep people coming back and engaged.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's a universal problem for arts organizations,
yeah.
You know, over-surveying, and yet we've got to have the information.
Right.
Is that a problem in your industry?
I mean, P&G prides itself on really understanding its consumers, right?
Yeah.
So understand that consumer, understand the consumer insights, understanding where their unmet needs are all very important. And I think, you know, that is the same whether you're talking about selling soap or selling a symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, we have one of your marketing people on our board and on our marketing committee. And so we also are looking at the expertise that corporations like P&G have to help us.
Right.
We can't do it at that scale, but certainly be able to understand better how to get that information and to act on it.
Emily, one of the things that you said earlier was, you know, really how do we change and adapt, right, in this environment? I think some of it is how might you bring in discontinuous thinking, right? So if you bring in people who are less familiar, it is, I think, raises more questions. But I also think there's an opportunity to share expertise in different spaces. So just as I bring a creative approach to business, I think there are business experts and analysts who can bring, you know, their expertise in creative venues to really help complement what the thinking is and to challenge what some conventions are.
That's absolutely true. And I know that we're very fortunate in Cincinnati, you know, the nonprofit sector as a whole, to have the expertise and engagement that we have from our corporate partners. It really is a special, I think, partnership because it's all about, you know, a win-win. The stronger our arts organizations are, the stronger our region is. And that recognition on both sides is really one of the keys to success here. I want to talk about a little more about the current audience and then the future audience. I feel like there's a kind of a conundrum where, you know, we might do all the work. We're on the journey as staffs and boards. In fact, ArtsWave has asked all 40 of its operating grant recipients to have board-approved DEI plans with measurable goals that we're tracking together in a way. We're on this journey together. But for all that work, if, you know, if the person sitting next to me in Music Hall isn't doing the work, it could really make for an unpleasant experience. For an African American or another person of color who is trying the symphony out, or is a lifelong lover of music and just as liable to be in that seat as anyone else. So we have this conundrum because people, we want culturally curious people, right? Mm-hmm. Empathetic, tolerant at the very least. But we are post-COVID in this mindset of only seeking out what's familiar, right? Broadway shows are selling if they are the traditional titles. Mm-hmm. The new work isn't selling. The ballet has said that on this podcast, that, you know, the Nutcracker will sell out, but new works struggles a bit. So if we're all seeking the movie we saw last year that made us laugh and feel better, how do we expect to mix up the audience and create that culturally curious community?
I think there are some common themes across all of our differences, right? So even, you know, the arts world as I know it has evolved tremendously in my lifetime. Certainly it has evolved even faster and more since we all kind of went into COVID, right? So change is familiar to all of us. But I think if we were to kind of double and triple click on what those experiences, what those interests, what those areas of opportunity are across any of the spectrum of people, I would suspect across at least two groups, right? There would be some commonalities that can be the catalyst to bring people together or to implore them to come discover, discuss, explore something different. I mean, I hope, like in my core, that the arts can be an objective thing that helps encourage fruitful conversation, or at least gives you an opportunity to see things from a different perspective without it having to be argumentative.
That's right. That is the power of the arts. We just need more people drinking the Kool-Aid. Yeah. I mean, how do you see it, Harold?
I completely agree. It's a huge dilemma as we try to appeal to, as I keep saying, a younger, more diverse community and demographic, because we are not trying to throw out, again, what has been so successful for so long. I remember doing a Harvard Business School executive education session called Leading Innovation in Existing Organizations. And I remember case studies that talked about, you know, IBM becoming the richest company in America through the mainframe business, but people started wanting PCs. So they didn't stop the mainframe business. They figured out how to innovate within to be the provider of both. Or USA Today, the world's largest daily paper, everybody wants their news digitally. So companies have to figure out, similarly, our organization has to figure out that we need our great longtime supporters and subscribers and donors and board members, but we also have to find ways to innovate and do both. So that's the central challenge. I think what we're doing is through programming, a variety of programming. There are only so many dates on the calendar, but we're trying to figure that out. What's the right mix? How can we draw really different kinds of audiences and reach out and market to audiences that are going to really value the kind of programming that we're trying to bring. So we're making some progress, but it's a longer journey. It's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, for sure. Tyson, you were one of the founders of the Flow Initiative at ArtsWave, and that really is about creating that audience that we know is possible at our core, right? Maybe describe for everybody what Flow is or what the opportunity that you see is.
Right. I think when we started the conversation on Flow, kind of referring back to some of what we've already discussed, is when you look at the audiences at our major arts institutions, they aren't nearly as diverse as we would like for them to be. And how might we really be able to encourage, produce, and support content and arts experiences that allow a more diverse audience to come out and enjoy the arts in Cincinnati? These things are crucially important, right? So Flow's job now, right, is to be able to curate and help produce and amplify regional experiences that help people from Black and Brown communities really be able to see artists that they can relate to, that may be more resonant with them, that give them an opportunity to come out and enjoy the same levels and kinds of experiences that our counterparts are.
It's been a real honor to work on that initiative with you and others, and to be in the room when we are successful at attracting that much more balanced audience. I mean, we even intentionally shoot for as close to 50-50, white, white, non-white in the room, whether it's the Jarson Kaplan or the museum where we're having a party. And people say, this is a different group than I'm normally in.
And I mean, I think it's meaningful and important, right? I think we are all more comfortable being in environments and with people that either we are familiar with or that are more like us, right? When we feel as though we are not like the folks around us, it makes us feel excluded and it makes us feel uncomfortable. But as we are able, I think, to pull more diverse people together to enjoy the same thing, it also hopefully sparks conversation and connection amongst those people that will allow them to grow their arts experiences overall.
Yes. That brings up the challenge, the other conundrum we have, which is the future audience, and the reality is that arts education is cut so much, right? So we don't have a pattern of behavior necessarily coming up in the next generation, goers to the symphony, goers to the theater. And I wonder, you know, we also know that reduction in arts education disproportionately affects communities of color. So we're like in this double bind, right? We're not getting kids early enough feeling welcome and included and engaged and contributing to what the content should be. So Harold, how does the CSO look at the problem of arts education and what are you doing?
Yeah, there's no question that age is right up there with race and ethnicity as our two most challenging diversity dimensions. And so we have a learning department that has put forth youth orchestras and does what we call music in schools, send some of our musicians out to do workshops with music teachers or with the CCM, Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. So we've had some programs there. So we've just recently done a strategic plan for that department to figure out how we can even be more impactful. Because, you know, one of the things a former boss of mine used to say, we need to stop thinking so much about what we are talking so much about what we're doing and talk about what we're accomplishing. It's one of those things that I live by. So so we had a lot of programs. So the question was, are they doing what we need them to accomplish as we try to spread the appreciation and the performance opportunities for youth in terms of orchestral music? And so it's a big world out there. It's a big community out there. So we can't touch everybody that we want. But from an equity point of view, we're really trying to provide opportunities for those who otherwise won't have access. And it's a pathway investment. Pipeline investment. So even at the elementary years, we're trying to find opportunities for that after school programs, partnering with community organizations to provide opportunities for the young people, not only to perform, but to gain an appreciation for this kind of music, and then find steps for them to be able to proceed. If they are interested in performing, what are some of the next steps that they could do? But it's complicated. If you don't have exposure in your home, or you don't have a music program in your school, or parents who are able to afford lessons or instruments, it's the whole pathway is lined with barriers, frankly, mostly economic. And so we're trying to figure out what's our niche and how can we partner with others in the community to, again, from an equity point of view, to be able to help those young people achieve the same goals as their more affluent counterparts.
I'm glad that you mentioned the equity issue. And but one of the things I wanted to be sure to share is that part of this year's ArtsWave campaign, we have a special initiative to raise sufficient funds to provide 50,000 field trips over the next several years.
This is huge.
It is huge. And the 50,000 number comes from all of the kids in Cincinnati Public Schools, grades 1 through 6, with the idea that every year, every grade will have at least one field trip and in a curricularly appropriate way. Right. So tied to the curriculum and, and the right age. And with the idea that by the time they graduate sixth grade, they will have experienced being inside a music hall or an experienced the art museum. Like the doors are not as
Which I think is critical. Right? I was having a conversation before we started with some of the team here just about recalling my grade school trips to the symphony and to children's theater. And the fact that it makes you more familiar allows you to be able to have a conversation. So even now, you know, at near 50, I can remember fourth or fifth grade trips to go see Peter and the Wolf and the conversation around that and what that means. I mean, it's, I would not have thought that at that time, but it was a pretty big deal to be able to go on those trips and enjoy those kinds of experiences and be able to have those conversations. And I think the more familiar audiences are with the symphony, with the art museum, the more belonging they have and the more likely they are to go explore those places and spaces when they're not at school.
Yeah. Familiarization is really important. And that first arts experience, like you just described, like that sticks with you, right? And those times with your peers in a different environment, it's not just time away from school. It's not just entertainment. It's creating social bonds and having a different kind of experience that opens your mind.
I mean, it
really does work that way. Across the arts community, how are we engaging audiences in spaces that have been historically underrepresented, both in the audience and as performers? How do we entice folks to give us a try? And I think I come back to, is it marketing or is it product? Enticement.
I think it's a matter of, again, being empathetic to who we're trying to reach. What is their normal? How do you show up in their spaces in their normal rather than trying to force them to consume what's normal for us, right? So I think even just that reframe can be incredibly enabling for folks who might be less familiar, right? None of us really want to go dive headlong into something that we know nothing about for no reason, right?
And
I think that's the position that we find a lot of our potential audiences in.
Absolutely. You know, and the pandemic hasn't helped. We've all become very comfortable consuming entertainment, you know, in front of a screen.
And even that, I think, is an opportunity for how we rethink how we do what we, technology has enabled us to do lots of things. I mean, as evidenced by this conversation, do lots of things very differently. How do we leverage and incorporate that as a part of how we think about our programming and reach to get to consumers and to get to audiences? It's required that we think about that.
Harold, we have a really symphony-specific question that you're going to need to explain a little bit about the blind audition process. And what is that, and is it a good thing or not a good thing?
Like most things in life, it depends on who you ask.
Okay.
But but there are numerous studies that have shown that there is bias in the audition process. And so the blind audition, bringing the curtain down, is an attempt to mitigate biases, and, you know, implicit bias, you know, there may be explicit bias too, but we're thinking about implicit bias. That is that the judges or the folks evaluating the audition performance do not know if the person is a woman or is a person of color or any other physical characteristics, even to the point of having a rug where, and we tell them not to wear heels so they don't hear the, you know,
click.
It's sad on the one hand that we have to do that, but it's also important so that folks are judged on the merits of their performance. So there's some people who believe from a sort of a pure art point of view that they want to see the person perform and the energy, particularly for leadership roles like being a principal, a chair or something like that. So there's some people who don't like that and they want to see that that performance with their own eyes. But on the other hand, again, it's undeniable that there's data exists that shows that. But it's the same thing with resumes, right? You have the same resume, change the name, and you get a very different evaluation. So that's what it's attempting to do. We believe in it at this point. And until we have data that suggests otherwise, I think we're going to be sticking with that.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And yet, even if you have that, the best possible way to minimize implicit bias, the pipeline problem still means that you're not likely to.
So we are investing in a number of pipeline strategies to help underrepresented musicians be prepared for that audition, because it really does come down to that audition performance. Nothing else is really considered. And so if we invest in a pipeline and help musicians who've not had maybe the best lessons or the best instruments or whatever else we know leads to a great performance or even the experience through mentoring and other ways. But there is no algorithm that, that lets you know that the whatever happens in that pipeline is going to result in a different outcome, because it didn't, again, at this point, we're only really allowed to consider the performance. So we're working with some musicians. We have a diversity hiring task force that's trying to figure out ways that we can be more upfront in our job descriptions and in other ways. So the expectation is that if you join the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, we expect you to be to embrace performing out in the community. And other things. And then some other things that, you know, with our diversity fellows, maybe there's an opportunity for them to automatically get at least one first round audition because we've invested heavily in them in our partnership with CCM. So we're looking at creative ways to do that. I think it's going to take sort of a major national effort. And that's why we're aligning with other major orchestras to figure out this, because representation on stage matters. We know that. For young people, but also for audience goers, they want to see folks that look like them on that stage. And right now we have one African American in our orchestra of something like 90, one permanent person, a permanent seat, and he's been there since 1975. So we're dangerously close just looking at the African American piece. And so we're really aggressively trying to recruit and trying to find ways to increase representation.
Sure.
And one other thing about that, so that's an important topic that we don't talk enough about. And so, because it just seems like a big ocean. So what we've tried to do is measure ourselves long-term against the MSA, the Metropolitan Statistical Area, and try to be representative of that area. And then in the short term, we're looking at our industry. We want to be amongst our leaders in terms of our representation on stage among other major orchestras. So we're trying to think in a graspable way what it is that we can take on and formulate our strategies to get to those points, as opposed to trying to proverbially boil the ocean on this front. But it's hard work, and it's challenging. So, but we're determined to make a difference.
Well, it certainly seems like you're on a good path, and I appreciate and applaud the commitment of the organization and, you know, the willingness of the musicians also to be on the journey, because, you know, musician contracts haven't historically necessarily included playing in the park, right?
And it's not, you know, there's no consensus around that. So we get, you know, I have occasional emails and comments about why do we have to play that music or play there.
Really?
But for the most part, and our last two classes have been more open. I think they're younger. They're more, they've had different experiences coming in. And so they're more open to some of the things that we've determined to be important.
I want to wrap up with a question that brings it back, you know, to why it's important from PNG's perspective. Like, kids being exposed to the arts and having the chance to listen or to play, to be inspired, like, that comes full circle by the time they're looking at their career choices, right?
Yes. I mean, this is a very pertinent conversation kind of for me in my career, as well as for the organization as a whole, right? So if I speak about, you know, the role of design as a critical component of how we do our work and do our business, we struggle with some of the same difficulties that we see in the arts, which is how do you nurture and develop a diverse pipeline of talent so that you can always fulfill your own goals and needs. Our goal, like Harold's, is that, you know, we should be able to represent the population of people that we serve. And so as I think about how that plays out in the arts community, there is a very similar, what I'd like to say is a commitment, right? And hopefully everyone feels committed that we are growing a more diverse audience. But I also think that it means that we have to be more inclusive and more diverse in terms of how we are thinking. So when folks ask, why do we have to play that music? Why do we have to play it there? I think some of that comes through the familiarity that we talked about. It's what they know as the norm, but my norm may not be others' norm. So how do we challenge ourselves to meet people where they are? How do we challenge ourselves to really be able to inspire the next generation to want to be involved? And if we can do that, then I think we can build a better flywheel to really make sure that we are filling the pipeline, we are inspiring people, we are encouraging people to either be involved or to contribute to or to donate to the arts as an ecosystem.
That is a long-term
It is not simple. It requires a sustained effort and attention. It's not something we can do and be done with.
Yeah. No, it is not. And, you know, creativity is something that corporations seek. And I've seen statistics that the majority of CEOs in the United States can't find the creativity they're looking for. You even have that in your title, Right Brain to the Business. What does that mean?
It's a title I gave myself. So
There isn't a whole band of Right Brains to the Business?
No, there is one. And when I think about being the right brain to the business, it's really about speaking to the unique role that I found within P&G to really be a creative thinker and creative problem solver and an asset to the business, just as we have folks who are incredibly analytical.
Sure.
And that is important to the business. It is also important that we find new and creative ways to solve the problems that emerge new or that we have struggled with over time. And mm-hmm. I think it, you know, my responsibility is to bring that unique capability to the businesses that I work on so that we can be better.
And I bet that fourth or fifth grade trip to Peter and the Wolf started you on that journey. And yeah, I mean, that the fact that that is valued within your corporation and that's what they tap you for, you know, really does speak to the power of imagination and how do we get more imagination at work in our community. I mean, Harold, you see the light bulbs of kids going off all the time, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, my role, I'm one of the few people that does not have a classical music background in terms of performance or studies, but my role, I would never compare myself to you as being the creative mind, but the point is that I do bring an outside perspective.
Sure.
And so folks are always doing things around DE&I, but what I can be is a critical friend and a mm-hmm. collaborator that helps them think differently about equity, about how to connect to the community, and in a variety of ways that are sort of the traditional way of doing business in the classical music industry. So in a similar way, I think I play sort of iron sharpens iron kind of role that's beginning to pay off, I think, in some new and creative ways to reach our goals.
I know that we mentioned technology a few moments back. When the pandemic hit and the CSO quickly pivoted, a business word and a dance word, you got the capabilities to go digital probably faster than most arts organizations. And did the audience look different in the chat? Or did you track people from other places?
Yeah, well, both end. I mean, we hired a director of digital strategy, I think is their title, to really help us shape that. And invested in the technology that was needed to do that. And so during the pandemic, we were able to reach a much broader audience far and wide with our programming. We still hear comments from folks. And even now we are live streaming certain programs as a matter of access for those who can't make it down to music hall or don't desire to, frankly, but can still have access to the music. But there's no question about it that has to be part of the core strategy going forward. Mm-hmm. We do try to demystify music hall by having people come in and have events that would like to think are inviting. But the technology is a way to reach folks, and we're continually investing in that.
That's awesome. So innovation definitely at work.
Oh, yeah.
The arts are putting Cincinnati on the map in new ways because of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that you're doing is really important for setting up the future. So thank you for being committed to that. And Tyson, thank you for all that you do for the arts in your spare time.
I'm trying.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. And for being that creative perspective in the room always. And that's how I would describe you. Now I will label you as the right brain to the business. Anything else before we go from our chat room? Any big aha moments recently in the arts?
Wow.
Yeah.
I would say, again, having been with my peers a few weeks ago, I feel very fortunate to be not only in my own organization, but in Cincinnati. I mean, I think about and hear some of the barriers that they're up against trying to change traditional thinking, programming. I feel like we are ahead of most. And we get that feedback.
Yes.
That, you know, I mean, I was 3 weeks into the job and I was asked to present at the conference. It goes to show you the dearth of folks doing this work. But I really do feel fortunate that this is a very generous community. And even though we have some people who know what they like and like what they know and don't want to see change, I think the majority of folks that we interact with understand the importance of our being more relevant to a broader segment of the community and are beginning to embrace that. And folks who traditionally have been underrepresented in our industry are finding something in our lineup that appeals to them, whether it's Common coming back in October performing with the symphony or the upcoming Classical Roots. So we've got something for everybody. So that diversity of programming is only increasing. And I'm hoping that our traditional subscribers are not feeling like anything's been taken away. I think it's the power of and. I think we're able to do both. And that's the way we're going to stay relevant and attract the entire community to our works.
Fabulous. We'll let that be the last word from soap to symphony. This has been such a fun conversation and really inspiring. Cincinnati, you know, for all the challenges we do face and confront together, just this last December was ranked for the second time as in the top 20 regions for arts vibrancy in the nation out of more than 900 regions by SMU Data Arts. So top 20, which looks at the volume of activity.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
It looks at the generosity of our community, mm-hmm. and it looks at the way we are competitive nationally and internationally.
I would just say thank you to ArtsWave, too, because you are the catalyst, you are the convener.
Absolutely.
And your support is undeniably important. So we certainly congratulate and thank you all for all that you do for the arts community.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Harold Brown, Tyson Betts. I'm Alicia Kittner for Arts Wrap, and I'm sure I'll be seeing you around town and at Music Hall. And until then, everyone, it's a wrap.